You're listening to a 95BFM podcast. Now it's time for our weekly chat with Labor MP Andrew Little.
It is indeed time to hear from Andrew Little again. This week he's talking to us in his capacity as Minister of Secret Intelligence Services. Let's get straight into it. We've seen a big article come out by Guy and Espiner this week about raids to the Czechoslovakian embassy back in the 80s. Yeah. He asked you if you've ever signed off on break-ins, and one of your responses was that now, compared to the 80s, we have a much more rigorous oversight regime in terms of our national security agencies.
Yep.
Is your implication that there's sort of no need for break-ins now because we have a more robust regime and don't sort of have to resort to approaches like that?
No, I guess, I said two things. One of the things I said, I don't comment on operational things or methods because I don't comment on what our agencies do or don't do, because those who would cause us harm want to know not just what we do, but what we don't do. But what I said in the context of talking about the oversight, is the implication, I think, from the podcast was that our agencies kind of are a rule unto themselves and they don't care about the law. And I can't account for what happened in the 80s, except that breaking into embassies, particularly east versus west sort of stuff, was rife around the world. But we have the law that our agencies operate under, the Intelligence and Security Act, very clearly lays out if they want to do stuff that would otherwise be unlawful, what they have to do to justify it. And added to that is two things. One is a much, much beefed up Office of Inspector General of Intelligence and Security. So up until about 5 years ago, the Inspector General of Intelligence and Security was literally a part-time position. There was one person working half-time with a little bit of clerical support. Now we have an Inspector General, a Deputy Inspector General, and an office of about nine people, including investigators and others. Every warrant that the agencies operate under automatically goes to the Inspector General, who then investigates and examines it. The Inspector General has a right of access to the agencies at any time, a right to make any request of any information. And any incident, whether it's a staff one or involving anybody that the agencies have interacted with, the agencies have to notify the Inspector General and any member of the public who think they've been wrongly treated or dealt with by the agencies can go to the Inspector General, who has a complaint sort of regime set up. So none of that was in place 30 years ago, so that it is a different kettle of fish today.
Okay. Now, you did also say that our New Zealanders want our agencies focused on national security interests. Where does that focus lie significantly in modern Aotearoa?
I think the biggest threat we face is cybersecurity, and we're no different to pretty much the rest of the world on that. Because so much is done online, so much is transacted, so much data is processed, and so much data is stored in various places. And we know that one of the kind of bad actors who are on the internet, they are constantly searching for information, for data, for places to store their malign data. So that is a big thing, and we're constantly having to make sure that we're equipped to deal with that. We know, for example, child sexual exploitation online is a big and getting worse issue.
Right.
Huge amount out of the Netherlands, huge amount out of the Philippines, and for the rest of the world, we've got to be, we've got to be equipped to deal with this and track down those who are causing harm to others. So that's it. But look, we also the standard things, keeping our bigger businesses, we need to know that they are safe and secure. Our people, those who would cause threats to us, whether through forms of extremist violence or terrorism, we've got to be alert to that as well, and we've got to have the means to investigate and track down and keep people safe.
It's interesting to hear you touch on cybersecurity, because the difference of these break-ins having occurred in a Cold War context, what our relationship with Russia is more like, in your opinion, now, particularly given the context of accusations of collusion.
Yeah, look, I mean, look, the relationship has changed. The Russia is not the same as the old Soviet Union, where they were, you know, well, Russia was still a nuclear power, but the Soviet Union was very much in that, in the arms race, very competitive with the US, and had a very aggressive kind of diplomatic and geopolitical strategy of dominating and, you know, developing their alliances to counter Western influence. That was what was happening. That was what the Cold War was all about. Russia since then doesn't have the big alliances that it used to have as the old Soviet Union, but it still does. It reaches out and it's active in the Middle East, for example. But it has become more of a menace state. So it does, and you look at the campaigns that it runs to undermine democracy in Western countries, and that's what, you know, what was happening in the United States in 2016 was all about. And they do it through online means. They have, you know, they have mastered the art of setting up bots to dominate Facebook and Twitter and others. They set up these fake accounts that are deliberately provocative. They do those sorts of things. So they they are very active in that space. It is not. It's not quite clear what the ultimate objective is, except to cause a bit of destabilisation and upset that makes it easier for them to do what they want to in the parts of the world where they're active.
Okay. It's interesting to hear you touch on, Twitter and Facebook and the employment of bots. I wonder, do you not see corporations like Facebook and Twitter who have the technology to spy on us? Is there not a focus on those kind of corporations as a threat to New Zealand's national security?
Only to the extent that they are a platform for others to exploit and abuse and use. I think... I think the Twitters and the Facebooks and those other very large online platforms, they are typically acutely aware of, you know, the number of subscribers they have, the dominance they have and can have, and the place or the role they play in a lot of people's lives. I think the big challenge for them is getting them to understand, and I think I think Twitter does. I think Facebook's struggling to understand that. Their platforms can be used for malign purposes, and they can do something about that. In terms of data they collect, personal information they collect about people in store, I think they are aware of the sensitivities there and do their best to make sure that that isn't open to abuse. Although, you know, we saw the stuff with Cambridge Analytica and we saw what could happen there. But I think the biggest threat they pose is that they are ubiquitous and they can be used and abused by others with a deliberate intent of, you know, causing political instability at sensitive times, and that's, that we all have to be alert to that.
Mm. So moving back to the example of political instability in the US and Russia sort of inserting themselves into that in 2016, one critique by a podcast of immigrants to America from Russia and Belarus is that Americans like to fixate on this idea of collusion in 2016 because they won't accept that America is as corrupt a political institution as Russia is. What do you think of this critique, especially in the context of Black Lives Matter protests spreading to New Zealand and generating conversations about the fact that we have political ties with America?
Gee, there's a lot in that sort of question. But I think, I have read most of the, probably 75% of the Mueller report, and I think it is pretty clear there was an organised campaign and strategy out of Russia to try to influence what was happening in the United States general election in 2016. I don't think there's any doubt about that. That is not to say that the nature of the US political system is not prone I think it's in a hugely sort of problematic state. I think that's what's being played out at the moment. It's a hugely polarised political makeup, and it's been kind of driven apart. And as the United States confronts issues like the, you know, racism and prejudice by police against black people, and policing styles that are more militaristic and less discriminating, less about community engagement, then, you know, they are having great difficulty coming to terms with that. And it doesn't help when you've got, you know, a president who doesn't seem capable of you know, providing any leadership in the circumstances. So that's all being played out. But in terms of, and I think, you know, Russia and through outfits like their Internet Research Agency, which is the outfit that does all the destabilising sort of activities, they see that and they pick that, and therefore they find the opportunities to provoke those divisions. And you hope you have leaders in place at all levels of their political system that understand that and know how to respond to it, but that doesn't seem to be the case.
Mm.
In terms of our relationship with the US, I mean, like any country that we work closely with, those relationships operate at a number of different levels. There's a trade relationship, a diplomatic relationship, there's the kind of political, there's the person-to-person, there's the NGO to NGO, all that sort of stuff. And we do have a good relationship with the US, and no doubt we reserve our views about some of the bad parts of the US, and no doubt they reserve their views about us. But there's a lot of good that comes out of the US, but it is a country that is, I think, deeply troubled, and that's coming to the fore at the moment.
Mm.
And in relation to Black Lives Matter, look, we've got our issues about our history that we are still coming to terms with, a quite racist history and colonialist history that has caused oppression, and we are still struggling to come to terms with that. But I think we have a police force that equally is adapting to different styles of policing that is about, you know, more community-oriented, about understanding that people who end up being drawn into our criminal justice system, most of them are there because of lives that they've led over which they've had no choice, being exposed to violence and a bunch of other influences and learned behaviours. We've got to find a different way to deal with that than just throwing people in prison and hoping they get better, because that's not how it works. And I think the police are across that view.
Okay. There is evidence, though, that, moving to this conversation that we've been having over the last couple of weeks about the armed response trials, which, of course, have now ended, and obviously there was a big announcement in relation to that this week, but yesterday there was also evidence that came out that Māori made up over half of the instances in which force was used by police in these trials. Does that concern you at all? Do you acknowledge that could be evidence that the police aren't over community initiatives and doing better?
Yeah, look, I'm not saying they're anywhere near where I would like them to be in terms of a community policing approach.
Right.
And we know, look, you've only got to look at the criminal justice statistics to see who is massively overrepresented in our prison numbers and our criminal justice numbers, and it is Māori. So there is something about the way we are policing and enforcing the law that has led to this incredible bias. So that is there, absolutely. Don't deny that at all.
Yeah.
But what I do see is a much greater effort amongst more of our police that demonstrates a greater understanding about what is causing offending. Look, when a person beats up somebody else, of course there's got to be an intervention that's taken out. When somebody causes serious harm to another person, of course you want the police there to intervene and do their thing. But we know that there's a lot of other offending, including offending that causes harm, that actually, after the initial intervention and getting people in safe places and all the rest of it, actually requires an intensive approach to deal with what has caused that behaviour and those sort of attitudes, and that's a longer-term game.
Yeah. I would like to ask one last question that relates to everything that we've talked about today. Obviously, at the start, you yourself mentioned that you won't comment on operational matters. We've also seen Jacinda Ardern use the term operational matters in the conversation about that as well, policing in New Zealand. What exactly does that mean? Let's break it down a bit. This week was actually the first time I've heard the term. So,
okay, no, it's a good question, because it is probably used a little more than it should be. So there's when it comes to the police are constitutionally independent from the executive government, put it in those terms. So we have an independent constabulary. What that means is that when it comes to enforcing the law, deciding on prosecutions and who gets prosecuted and what for, those decisions are completely independent of ministers and public servants, or other public servants, because they have to be. You don't want a situation where a politician could interfere in or seek to influence forms of policing or prosecutions and what have you. So we've got to keep that independent. So we often say about the police, they get to make a set of decisions that we expect them to at least keep the minister notified of, but they are their decisions as long as they're keeping within their budgets and all the rest of it. If we wanted to change that, then for politicians or for Parliament, we'd have to change the law to require them to act in certain ways. But the way politicians speak to the police force is through statute. It's a bit like the judges. We don't, no one interferes in what judges do. We don't direct judges. If we want judges to do something different to what they've done, then we have to change it, or Parliament has to speak to the courts.
Right.
Sometimes I think the excuse about it's operational is, ministers can't be responsible for managing the staff and the departments for which they're responsible. And so that gets trotted out to say, oh, well, that happened, but I'm not responsible. Actually, ministers are politically answerable for things that their departments say or do, and so that excuse about it's just operational is, should not be fallen back on at every given opportunity. You do have to discern what is genuinely something that a minister is not responsible for. And something
that was Labour MP Andrew Little. The Wire. That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.